Good afternoon. So last time we finished up talking about remote procedure calls. Talked about, well, we have this interface description language. Why aren't we just using a header file? We gave some examples of how RPC calls looked, and we saw that in gRPC, my example of a real commercially used RPC system, that maybe they strayed a little bit further from what we might imagine is the closest thing to a normal function call. And part of this was for reasonable reasons, like wanting to be language neutral and trying to support working the same in all different machines and so on, and handle errors. We also talked about ways in which RPC just can't be transparent. The biggest one is that, well, failures happen in a very different way between two machines than not. You also have issues like, well, it's going to be slower than local call, and that sometimes exposes itself. Then we moved on to talking about the distributed transaction problem, and we had this idea that, well, we're going to do a transaction, something that happens or doesn't, across multiple machines, and we had a protocol for implementing this called two-phase commit. And the idea of this is that we'd have a coordinator, which is doing the operation and coordinating it, and the workers, which store the data that was being changed by the transaction. So we have the example of, we had our course system, we had worker machines that stored student and course data, and a coordinator, which was, you know, adding a student to a course or something like that. And in two-phase commit, we have this two steps. First, the coordinator collects what all the workers want to do, then it chooses an outcome. And the outcomes we're allowed to choose are, well, if everyone agrees to commit, we actually do the transaction. If anyone aborts, or if we're unsure what's happening, we can always abort. And if anyone aborts, we must always abort. And we've had logs in this system so we could deal with failures. Assuming our failures look like the machine goes away for a while and then comes back, the machine will remember the last thing it put in its log accurately. And from this, the coordinator can figure out, oh, I decided to commit, that was my decision. Or worker can figure out, I voted to commit, that was my decision. And we can make sure that we end up with the correct, consistent outcome. But we did have the issue that, well, if the machine goes away, potentially we could be waiting forever to actually figure out what happens, especially, you know, at least until the machine comes back. There's some things we can do to mitigate that, but like worst case is the machine goes away, we're just going to be paused there, unsure whether the transaction will happen or not. And we looked at expressing this more formally, and one way we had to do that was this idea of a state machine, where we had the state, which was basically what's the log of the machine tell us it's doing right now. And based on the state, we decided how we would respond to messages and other things like failures and so on. So, questions about things we covered last time? Yes?
Kind of a question on the assignment. Can we use the state machine idea to kind of work our way through the two-phase assignment with those state
machines? So, the question is, can you use state machines in your assignment code? Absolutely.
No, I mean like the ones we went over.
Will the state machines tell you work for the homework? Yes. The biggest caveat is that I may have omitted some like cases that might come up, and things like how you deal with multiple transactions and things we'll talk about later today. So other questions? Okay. So when we left off, we were looking at examples of how two-phase commit works. So our normal operation is we have our coordinator like saying, hey, I want to add this student to the class. It tells each of the workers, I would like you to prepare to do this operation. And then we go into, you know, what we said was our waiting state. And then the coordinator collects the responses from the workers, and the workers say, yep, I can do that. It goes into this committed state, and that committed is the global decision. We're all committing, so it tells the workers about it, and they actually do the operation. And on our workers, you know, we have our initialization state, and here we remember we agreed to commit. Why do we need to remember that? Because we have to make sure that if a failure happens, we still say that so nothing inconsistent goes on. That the coordinator doesn't get confused based on, you know, delayed messages and so on, that we don't see abort then commit from the same worker. Redo abort, the redo the commit. We also mentioned sort of our normal case where, like, our class was full. We'd say agree to abort. The coordinator, you know, once it collected all its votes, it would go into its aborted state and tell the workers about that. Yes?
So if in the class example, they all agree to commit, and before it actually goes and commits, all the classes fill up.
So the question is, what happens in the class example if during this time, now, you know, what if class is full, if class fills? And the answer is this is not allowed. So because worker one has agreed to commit it, it cannot allow that conflicting operation to occur. And because it agreed to commit this, you know, it has to take back something else rather than this. Now, I'm giving the example where we just don't allow classes to become full. Like, probably in a system like SIS, the real solution might be you allow the class to be overloaded. But, you know, if we're being strict about this, we're just going to say, not going to allow that conflicting thing to happen because we agreed to commit. Okay. And I guess I should say, I'm not a databases person, so I don't actually know the details of, like, real database ways of doing this. But my vague understanding is that in a database which wanted to, like undo the operation, a response might be you start, like, the worker would commit the operation but then create a new transaction to remove the person from the class. If it wanted to, like, have that sort of let the class become full if we're waiting for a long time thing happening. Does that answer your question? Yeah. Okay, so conflict. So, of course, the interesting case is where we have failures. So in the case of failures, we have some options for what could happen. So one option is if the worker fails, the coordinator just keeps trying to ask the worker, hey, what's your vote? What's your vote? Until it finally gets one. Now, there's a simpler option, which is the coordinator just gives up. She says, nope, don't know what happened. I'm just going to abort the transaction. And I know I can do that because I get a say in deciding whether the transaction commits or not. I'm making my say no because I didn't know what happened. Or, and a third option is maybe the worker somehow figures out there's a transaction going on. For example, maybe it crashed after it got the prepare message and it resends the vote spontaneously. So where we fail after prepare, like one thing which can happen is that we have some sort of timeout, presumably, that the coordinator waits for a certain amount of time. If it doesn't get a response, it says, let's try again. And sees if it can contact the worker. And in this case, the worker, maybe it crashed without recording the transaction at all, but that's fine. It's going to get it now, and it's going to handle it. So the other option is that the coordinator can just say, okay, you know, I'm just going to abort it. And that's fine because the coordinator gets, you know, coordinator is one of the people who gets to vote on whether the transaction commits. It needs to be part of that unanimity first committee. Something I'd like to note about this worker failure after prepare is I'm showing you that the worker gets a message and fails, but from the coordinator's point of view, this is exactly the same as the message doesn't get there. And from the worker's point of view, if the worker doesn't write down anything about the message it receives, this is exactly the same from the worker. So these are indistinguishable and handled in exactly the same way. Okay. And our third option is maybe the worker remembered that it agreed to commit, in which case when it comes back up, it reads its log and says, oh, I agreed to commit, and sends a message back. This is not required. We could just wait for the coordinator to abort anyways. But this is a way we might abort less often. And as I said, network failure looks like node failure. So this applies to if we are sending the message to the worker. It also applies in the other direction. Remember, the coordinator, you know, it's always safe to abort, though it doesn't make progress. So if we have, like, the agree to commit message doesn't come back, the coordinator could ask again, or it could just say give up. So this is the simplest option. It could also decide, I'm going to resend the prepare message and get that vote which got lost by the network here, instead of aborting. Or the worker could somehow figure out, huh, it's been a while, let's tell the coordinator again, no, I agreed to commit, just in case. But we always have the safe option of the coordinator just gives up to make progress, which it can safely do as long as it's, you know, still has its say, it hasn't decided to commit the transaction. Now, the tricky cases here are when we can't just have the coordinator say, I'm going to abort. Because that was easy, right? We handled all our failures. You know, we had options which, like, might make progress more often, but we always had the safe option of the coordinator just gives up on the transaction. But then we have problems like, what if the coordinator commits and something goes wrong? So then we have two options. So one option is somehow, well, in either option, we have to somehow trigger the coordinator to resend that yes, I'm committed message. So there's two ways you might think of doing this. So one way is the worker could contact the coordinator again, say, I agree to commit, what happened? So the worker would have some timeout or something like that. It would say, it's been a while, this transaction, I told you the vote, what happened? And the coordinator would realize, oh, I guess you didn't get it, and resend, I committed it. Another option is that the coordinator resends the outcome somehow, but the good question is, like, how is it going to know to do that? Because as we've seen before, after we send commit or abort, there's nothing to do. So here, this is the case where the coordinator just, you know, gets resend the outcome because the worker came back up and resent its vote saying, hey, what happened? So as for the coordinator resending the outcome, well, we can do this, and this is the option we're going to do for the assignment because of how we structure our communication, and that's that we can have the workers acknowledge the commit message. And if the coordinator doesn't see this acknowledgement, it knows, I'm going to have to send it back. And we're not actually going to do this explicitly in the assignment, most likely, because you're going to send an RPC call to commit, and the RPC call has a return value, because gRPC has a return value from every RPC call, whether you want it or not. So you can just see, did I get a return value or an error? If you got a return value, the worker got the commit. And if it didn't, you know something's wrong, and you might need to resend it. Now, in the pictures I've shown, the way we've usually recovered from errors is we have this notion of a timeout. And this is what you do in a real system. You'd have things running all the time, and they'd automatically figure out, oh, it's been a while, and now we have a timeout. Timeouts are really, really annoying for testing. Right. How do you test that all your timeouts work? It seems like it's going to take a long time. You need to test what if it times out after we're retrying after the timeout. And to make our assignment simpler, we're going to simplify away the timeouts. So, you know, our notion is originally the coordinator would resend automatically. We're going to simplify this by just having your coordinator crash instead here. So your coordinator is going to just crash and reboot. And we're going to reboot it, and on reboot, you're going to do the resending. And you're going to do the same thing for all the other cases, like aborting after a worker doesn't respond and so on. But you'll just crash when you notice something seems to be wrong. And the idea is we'll reboot you. And on when we start your coordinator again, you're going to do whatever you would do after a timeout or whatever. So in our two-phase commit assignment, so just to see that formally, you're storing a single value across workers. So in a more realistic scenario, we'd have workers would have like different, like one worker would have students, one worker would have courses, and we'd update separate values. Just to keep things simple, we're updating, they're all storing the same value, but we want them all to change at once. And the workers are going to have a way of getting the current value where they're going to either return the current value or that it's unavailable. You can think of the returning it as unavailable as saying, I want to read the value, but there's a conflicting transaction, so you can't do that. If you think of the transaction, the read as a transaction, like that would conflict with a write. So you're going to return it's unavailable. So in a database system, this would manifest as when you do the read transaction, it would either wait or abort while the write transaction is happening. Here, to keep things simple, you just return, here's the value if it's available or false, basically, if it's unavailable. And our goal is, even if we have lots of failures and restart things, all the replicas always have this that same single value. If we imagine this being extended to a more, complete system, we'd have the replicas store different parts of some bigger thing, but they'd all have consistent versions all the time. Okay. And in this assignment, we use RPC. So the coordinator talks to the workers by making RPC calls. The workers aren't going to talk to the coordinator by making RPC calls, primarily because we don't set you up with a stub to talk in the other direction. So the only way the workers communicate to the coordinators by replying to an RPC. This is just to keep testing simpler, and I assure you it makes the implementation a little easier, even though there's some things that you just can't do. And an advantage of using an RPC system for this is the RPC system detects things like the worker being down or network errors for you, and in Python, it in fact turns into an exception. So remember I told you about crashing? Well, if you want to crash, just don't catch the exception. And because the coordinator only talks to workers, you need to verify the commit or abort is received rather than having the workers like ask for it to be reset. And as I said, you're going to always return an error when you detect a failure. Don't try to implement timeouts or anything. Just assume we'll restart you if you return a failure. And the important thing is after we start, if there's nothing's broken, we should get back to a good, consistent state, where either the last operation we started happened or did not happen in its entirety. And all the values are available now. Okay. And one other little note about the assignment. So we mentioned talking about our network, that we talk about a network, well, we send an RPC message, and sometimes it gets lost. Okay, that's normal. And we get, a failure. So failure at sender, and nothing at receiver. So nothing at the server, failure at the sender. Okay, that makes sense. Another possibility is it gets sent, but the reply is lost. So in this case, we have a failure at the sender, and we actually get the message at the receiver. So you need to handle that case. And there's a third case, which is a little subtle, which is that the RPC could get sent, but delayed until after another RPC. And what's going to happen is that it's going to fail at sender, and it's actually going to be at receiver, but late. So it's going to be received, just late, it's going to fail at the sender because presumably you're sending one message at a time. So I guess in my pictures, I've shown sending multiple messages at once. You don't need to do that, and probably you don't want to try. But if you're sending one message at a time, like presumably, like you're not sending multiple messages, but what will happen is you'll send one message, you'll think it failed, you'll send another message to the same place, and the two messages will arrive in the opposite order of what you sent them. So this is a failure reinject, and something which could happen on a real network. Remember we said messages could be delayed? So this is a case where a message got delayed, and it looked to the sender like the message was just lost, just because the sender didn't wait long enough. But really, it just was reordered. Now this is a bit tricky. Tricky to deal with. You know, so the issue is that you're going to have something like this happen, that you send a prepare, and it meant to go to worker 2 right away, but somehow it got delayed. You know, something went wrong in the network. Then you resend that prepare. You eventually commit the transaction, and then you send your next prepare. And then we receive the prepare for the first thing. So the way you keep this from being a problem, and the way real databases do it, is we're going to assign a unique identifier for each transaction, and we're going to have some way of knowing whether identifiers are out of date. In this case, they just are sequential, so I know if I see 0, if I'm on 1 from the same coordinator, well, that must be old. And it's probably the simplest solution. Some questions? Idea here. Okay. So this is something you need to worry about in the assignment, that the old request seems to fail and you repeat it again, but later that old failed request didn't really fail, it arrives late. Okay. Yes?
Should that be like added to like the message field and like the proto, or is that like
so the question is, should that be added to the you should choose. So in the assignment, so I guess I should go to this note. So if you started the assignment early, I accidentally put the my reference solutions version of the protobuf of the IDL rather than an empty version. You are not obliged to use any of the student added methods labeled in the messages they use. If you downloaded it when they were there, well, it doesn't really help you that much. And I'm not saying it's actually a good way to do it. It's just what I implemented when I was developing the assignment. But you can add whatever you want to that proto file, whatever methods you want to your coordinator and worker, and whatever things you want in the messages. So if you want a field that's like an int or a string for that ID, just add it. And if you want new calls, you know, you don't have to be the calls that are there, so you can add like a You can add new methods as many as you want or as few as you want to the coordinator and worker. For the coordinator, probably not useful, but for the worker, like that's how what the coordinator will call. You probably need some new things there. Other questions? I guess. So all we care about for that is that like we're going to call get value, get committed value, sort of get the committed value from the worker and set the value on the coordinator. That's what we care that works.
So those are the only two functions?
Yeah. So, but you're probably going to need other functions to implement that. So. And I guess that means that I probably should note that my base implementation of the worker has a set value method which isn't in there. I probably should modify that template again. But yeah, you add whatever methods you want to make the worker work. And note that you're failing, so you're you're crashing, so rather than timing out, you're going to crash, we're going to restart you. That's how it's going to work. Okay. So questions on assignment? And I guess I realized that in my assignment on the note on the on the skeleton code, some extra methods. The current IDL doesn't include the set value that's in the base skeleton code. I will correct that. That's something you can change, though. That's why it doesn't include it. It has the minimum set. But the base code does something that doesn't work with transactions, but it expects that set value method. Okay. So any other questions on two-phase commit? Okay. So you have that assignment coming up. And so we talked about two-phase commit. And in two-phase commit, we have voting, but it's unanimous. We need everyone to agree on the outcome. And this makes sense for that scenario where our data is split across nodes. So of course, everyone has to cooperate, or else it's not going to be consistent. There's another common use case for having multiple machines where everyone has a copy of a single piece of data, and we want to work despite failing nodes. With two-phase commit, if a node with part of the data goes down, we just don't make progress. But there's another model where we have multiple copies of the data, and we just want enough nodes to be working. So the way we can do that is we can use this idea of a quorum, that rather than requiring all the nodes to agree to do something, we're just going to require a threshold number. So for example, in this case, with five nodes, we might say if any three agree, quorum, this should be like of appropriate size, that's enough. Now we're going to say, if three agree, that's enough. B and E are going to figure this out later. Doesn't matter if they're down. We don't care. A, C, and D are enough, or A, B, and C. Any three nodes are going to be enough. So why would I choose three? What's the reason to choose three nodes here? Yeah. It's a majority. So what's the advantage of having a majority for this?
It's representative.
So it's representative. So there's some intuition there. So the reason I would choose 3 out of 5 here, so one way to think about it is, what if I'm doing an update? The important thing is I want to still see that update later. And in order to do that, I need to make sure I always contact someone who must have seen that update. And if I have a quorum size of 3, then every quorum overlaps with at least one node. So there's always one node who will know about that update that just happened, who is part of the previous quorum. Because if I take any subset of 3 of the 5, any two of those subsets, there's at least one node in common. So this ensures that I don't lose any information by doing this. I always have the latest version, because one of those three nodes must have the latest version, so they won't agree on what should happen unless it's actually the latest version. And this also suggests sort of how we're going to make sure it's eventually in sync. So when we do an update with A, B, and C, so we contact A, B, and C, and C says, I have a more recent version, then C can give that more recent version to B and A and make sure now B and A are in sync in the future. So now they have all the prior updates. So, as we're doing this, we eventually give everyone a copy of the data, assuming they come back up and we contact them. And most importantly, we have our consistency property because we just can't agree on anything that conflicts. Just because someone is going to vote no in the quorum, so we won't have enough. So I showed you this idea of majority quorum. Now, sometimes we do systems will do something where rather than just making the quorum be a majority, they'll choose different types of sizes of quorum for different operations. So a common example is that we'll have writes require a different number of nodes than reads. So one thing you might do is you might say updating data requires 4 of 5, but reading requires 2 of 5. But this still has the property that we're going to have overlap. Because any 2 nodes we contact are going to include 1 of the 4 involved in a write. And this is actually nice for performance, because probably in most systems we care about reads more than writes, not always, but if we care about reads more than writes, then a read that only contacts 2 nodes rather than 3 is going to be faster. And so this gives us a way to sort of trade off performance. It has a downside with failures, I mentioned. So the downside with failures is now I can't update the data if 2 nodes are down, whereas previously I could. So this idea of these quorum updates is really nice and very commonly used because you have just multiple machines and you want to take advantage of that to deal with machine failures. Or you have multiple sites, like you have a data center in LA and New York and Chicago, and you want to deal with any one of those going down and still have things work, you can use this strategy to make that happen. Now, the details are extremely tricky. So one thing which is extremely tricky is if you really want to handle any one machine failure or any 2 machines failing, one of those 2 machines could be your coordinator. And that's like where the biggest trickiness comes in. Like, if the coordinator, if the thing that was coordinating it fails, you need to somehow, rather than with two-phase commit, we just wait for the coordinator to come back. Like, that's a correct solution. That's not going to work if we need to handle any 2 machines failing. Then if that machine was coordinating the operation, now we need to select a different machine to coordinate the operation. But we need to somehow do this in a way where if the coordinator comes back, nothing goes wrong. And this makes the details really tricky and really nasty. So if you want the full details, there are 2 popular algorithms for this. Raft and Paxos. Paxos is the older one. Raft is a sort of reimagining, which, well, the paper authors would argue it's much simpler. Consensus opinion is probably somewhere in between. These are both implementations of this quorum consensus updates sort of protocol. I'll give a very high-level sketch of Raft. So Raft uses a high-level structure that's kind of very similar to our two-phase commit. We have a leader, which kind of looks like a coordinator. But because we need to handle any node going down, we select a leader, and we have a way of selecting a new leader if that leader fails. And to make this work, the leaders have sequence numbers. So each leader that's selected has a higher and higher number, and this is how when if someone like fails and comes back, they can realize, oh, I'm talking to the wrong leader. And the leader and the raft uses the other machines as sort of remote logs. So basically, we're doing redo logging, but we have multiple copies of the log. It's conceptually how it works on each of the nodes. And once the quorum has logged the operation, we know that it's actually going to happen. But there are, of course, lots of tricky details around failures. Some questions about this very high-level sketch? Yes?
If the leader fails, does he ever come back to be a leader?
Question is, if the leader fails, does he ever come back to be a leader? Yes. In the model where, yeah, that is possible. And it has to be possible because Raft wants to work if, like, different sets of nodes keep failing, and eventually, you know, so it could potentially be the case that you kind of, like, that you rotate the leader position around back to that person. When the leader comes back, they're not immediately leader? Yes. There's a currently selected leader, and that only changes when a majority of nodes agree, or a quorum of nodes agree. Other questions? Now, this is, as I said, rather complicated, but this is still only dealing with that fail-stop model. So remember I said fail-stop meant that when a failure happens, we would stop working at all. You know, the mode would stop working. But if we think about Byzantine failures, where I said the node fails by doing something annoying, something, the worst possible thing. And for something like two-phase commit or our quorum elections, an example of a really bad thing for the node to do is telling the first leader I agree to commit and telling the second leader I don't. And that's a real type of failure you could have. And there's other sorts of variations on that. And because you can have these inconsistent votes, there are algorithms which solve this, but the basic procedure is you need to ask everyone, I should say, not notes, but nodes. You need to ask everyone, hey, how did everyone else vote? And make sure it's consistent enough so you know that enough people are working. So this is even trickier. If you want to look it up, there the first practical algorithm for this is something known as practical Byzantine fault tolerance. That's a paper you can look up which describes how they do this. By the first practical one, I mean prior implementations had this problem of needing like n squared messages where n was the number of nodes, which becomes unwieldy very quickly. And they had a solution which wasn't as bad. Okay. So that's where I'm going to leave off on distributed consensus. Now we're going to go to a much more practical distributed system problem, which is network file systems. So if you log into the department machines, you may notice your files are always there as long as something isn't crashed. And the way that works, even though there's multiple machines you might log into, is we have a network file server. And the file system is backed by a remote machine. And one way you can imagine implementing this is with remote procedure calls that we can think of, okay, we make system calls, and let's just have the kernel translate those into remote procedure calls for us. Okay. So this is a way we could implement a remote file system. Now, this is sort of the high-level view of what our network file systems are doing, but there's some ways in which they don't quite work. So one question is, what is the server storing for us? Another question is going to be about crashes and performance. So let's start with what's the server storing. If we're just sending over the open calls and the read calls and so on, well, it's storing the open file descriptors. That's not actually that much. It's like what file, so like this is like inode number, and the offset in the file, and maybe the current working directory of all the clients to implement open correctly. Now, this isn't that bad, but this gets pretty expensive, actually. Because if we think of having like 90 lab machines and we're running like 50 processes, that's 90 times 50 copies of this for bit, times how many file descriptors they have. And this doesn't scale very well. But that's manageable. We could deal with that. But it's something that's not so great. Now, where this gets nasty is, what if a client crashes? So if a client crashes, well, we've just learned what crashes look like. Crashes, we don't always get to learn the machine's down. We just send it messages and they don't come back. But maybe the message is just taking a while. Maybe someone unplugged the network cable and hasn't plugged it back in yet. But the client's still running and still expects to access those files. But as the server, we'd like to know, well, if I've waited 60 minutes, can I delete that open file information? If I waited a day? A week? And there's no good answer there. That makes this sort of direct server stores the file descriptor approach not so great. We also have the question of, what if the server crashes? Well, we're going to restart the server or get a new one. But what's going to happen to the clients? Well, the clients have a whole bunch of file descriptors, and the information about what those file descriptors actually were referring to seems to be lost. So now if my file server goes down, I need to reboot every single machine in the department. Maybe we could do better. So I'm going to talk about a solution that's actually implemented, which does a little bit better. So this is going to talk about NFS version 2. NFS stands for Network File System. Sun Microsystems at the time did not decide to make up a fancy name for this. So version 2. There's a standard document called RFC 10.1094, written in 1989, which describes how this works. And it uses RPC calls. An older, different RPC system, but it's RPC calls. And it chooses something slightly different than just sending the open, read, write, and so on. So here are the RPC calls, a subset of them. So the first thing to know is we have these file IDs. So they've chosen, we're not going to have file descriptors. Instead, we're going to have some opaque information which tells us about a file. And when you want to open a file, you don't actually allocate a file descriptor. You get its file ID. And you can use that forevermore to access that file. And we're not going to store like a table mapping file ID to file. Instead, the file ID is going to contain the information we need to actually find the file on disk. So what typical NFS implementations do is they store the device and inode number in that token. They give it to the client sends it back, they look up the inode number again. They also store a generation number. I'll talk about that briefly later. So note that we also have some nice properties here in that our read takes an offset, kind of like the read you see in the FAT assignment, and our write takes an offset. So this means that for read and write, we don't need to remember the location in the file, the offset. Instead, the client is responsible for doing that. So this means the server doesn't need to track that information. So this is how we avoid having the server actually keep track of file descriptors. So the client is responsible for maintaining its mapping from file descriptor to the server, file ID, and offset. And this solves our problems of the client and server crashing. If the client crashes, that information is automatically deleted. We don't have to figure out when does the client go away. It's automatically deleted because it was in the client's memory, and the client's crashed. It's no longer there now. Sometimes this is called fate sharing. It has the same fate as the client, which is really handy. And if a server crashes and gets rebooted, it can use the same file ID and offset just like it did before it was rebooted. So as far as the client's concerned, it still works. And the server doesn't need to do anything as long as the client doesn't use the file. So the client can have a file descriptor open for days, and it doesn't take up any space on the server as long as it's just open and not being used. Okay. So I mentioned this idea about a generation number. So a tricky thing about using these file IDs where the server doesn't get to know when the client what the client has open is what happens when files are deleted. And a problem is that we might delete a file and then create a new file, and that new file might be stored in the same place on disk. And if we don't do anything about this, then later on, that rather than the client learning your file was deleted, there's a problem, or getting the data from the old file, it's going to get the data from the new file magically. So we don't want to allow that. So a solution to this is that they have a generation number. So each inode, just to support NFS, is going to store an extra field of metadata, which is incremented every time we reallocate the inode. And we compare that, and this way we can tell, hey, you're accessing a file which was deleted, and we can return an error rather than getting bogus data. And in fact, Linux file systems, if you look at their inodes, have a generation number field just to help implement things like NFS. There's nothing which uses it for local file systems, just for NFS. So what we end up with here overall, since I talked about we have our offsets and our file IDs, is we can call this a stateless protocol. By that, I mean the server doesn't store any states. All it does is take a message in, return the value out, and after it returns that value, there's nothing left to keep track of. And this is really attractive because it makes it really easy to handle failure, like we saw, and it also makes it so the server just has lower overhead. Because there's no data structures to manage. We're just accessing the normal file system. Now, one thing which might seem tricky here is, well, there's something here that I haven't shown. So one thing I didn't show how to do is how do we read directories? So one thing you might imagine is, oh, we're just going to have a call which gets all the files in a directory. But problem is some directories are really big, so we're not going to do that. So we're going to say, okay, so we'll have an offset in directories, but how does that work? So what NFS has chosen to do is they have this idea of an offset cookie. And so here we're repeating a pattern we saw. So with file IDs, we said, we'd really like the server, in our naive solution, the server would store the file descriptor and map that itself. But because we don't want the server to store that information, we send it to the client, and the client just blindly sends it back without knowing what it is. So we can do the same thing for reading directories for our offset in the directory. The client doesn't know what that means. Is that actually a number of bytes? Or is the directory stored as a tree and it's like a location in a tree? Doesn't matter. All the client does is it calls this readdir function, gets a bunch of names, and gets the thing to pass to the next call, this opaque cookie that it just sends back and forth without interpreting it. And this is a very nice general pattern by which we take something which would have been stateful. Like we used to have, the naive solution is we have readdir, read the next things, and the server has to keep track of where you are. And we made it stateless by just sending the information the server would track to the client and having the client send it back. So this gives us this is our stateless protocol. And this general trick is used a lot. So if you know how HTTP works, HTTP is stateless, even though it has clients keep track of information like this. It's stateless in a sense. Each request stands alone. We don't need to remember anything from the prior one. But that doesn't mean that we can't do things that look stateful on top of it. And we see NFS with this reader and with file IDs, it's doing that, even though the server doesn't actually track what the clients are doing. And this is an important distinction when we're thinking about protocols, in the sense of you can think of a stateful protocol as making the server do more work and less for the client, and stateless goes the other way around. And often we want to try to have stateless protocols for performance reasons, that it's hard to scale a server for many clients if it's stateful because we need to store info about every single client. It's also harder to handle failures because if the server fails, everyone's going to notice for a long time. Whereas with a stateless server, if the server fails, we just reboot it, we're set. So questions? So let's talk about performance. So before we had NFS, you might say, well, we were reading from disk anyways, but that's not really what was happening. We learned about the page cache. We're reading from memory. So it used to be that reading and writing files went to local memory. And because we did all this work to cache things in memory, do read ahead to make it just like reading from memory. And that meant that a typical open, read, write, and so on would take microseconds, because we're just accessing a local piece of memory with a system call. With NFS, now they take milliseconds, because that's how fast our networks typically are, is an order of milliseconds. Because now, even every operation, we have to contact the server, like open the file, get the file ID, read from this byte of the file each time. So even though the server might have all the data in its local memory, we still need to ask it about it, because it has the copy of it. Now you might say, well, why don't we just do caching like we were doing before? So the problem is, let's say I have a cached copy of my notes.txt. And let's say someone else writes to it. Now we have a problem. How does client A update its cached copy? When this was all in one machine, the answer was simple. Well, the write to notes.txt went to the cache copy. But that doesn't quite work out here, because we need some way of updating the copy. And because we have a stateless protocol, the server is not going to know about the cache copy. It's not going to keep that sort of information around about its clients. So our only solution is that the client needs to say, hey, do you have a, did it change? Did it change? Did it change? Did it change? And this is something we can absolutely do. But the problem is that it's not really faster. Yes, we're not reading another copy of it most of the time, but we still need to wait for the server to respond to our did it change message. And that's going to be almost as slow for a small text file. For a large file, obviously different. So we can do that, but we'd like to do better. So, and the other issue is, when do we tell the server about updates? So if client A updates its cache copy, how does client B end up reading the right updated version? Well, it seems like we can't write to our cache copy and have this work, that we have to tell the server right away. So these both seem like compromises. And it seems like, you know, in order to provide consistency, we need to always check the server before we use the cache copy and write all updates to the server in addition to our cache, which is going to make things a bunch slower. So it seems like any better solution is going to involve the server doing more work. Now, NFS said, I don't like this, but I don't want the server to do more work. So they have an alternative. An alternative that some of you are probably not going to like. And the reason they wanted to do this, though, is like because like we destroyed the benefit of caching. Because we have to ask the server, even if we aren't getting any data, it takes about as much time as getting a lot of data. So their solution is they're going to allow inconsistency. Say, we're not going to keep it consistent. And that's how we're going to get better performance. Now, you might say, that seems horrible. How am I going to ever use this file system? They're not going to allow all types of inconsistency. They're going to be careful about it. And to think about this, let's think about how normal programs we use work. So a word processor, if you open a file, it opens it, reads it into memory, and then closes it. And when you save the file, it opens it, writes out what it has in memory, and closes it. So something to note here is that we don't actually have like two files opening at the same time. It's not actually that common, given how normal programs work. Another thing, let's think about your expectations. So let's say I have a word processor, and I'm on a shared file system. If I open a file while someone else is saving it, what do I expect to happen? So let's say we're both SSH'd into the same machine, so it's even a local file system. What do I expect to happen? I need volunteers. What do you think I should expect? No. Yeah. So you think you'll get the old copy?
Yeah.
Okay. Any other things people might expect? Yeah.
Is the open to be delayed until the save is done?
So the open to be delayed until the save is done, so that's another possibility. So is there anything else people might think might happen? Yeah.
An error message saying that it's currently in use.
So an error message, okay. Any other options? So someone already mentioned getting the older version. So I think there's a third option, another option, which is you could potentially imagine that. So some one option is you say the word processor is going to stop you from opening and saving at the same time. So that's one option, is it's going to stop you from doing that. And given the procedure I described here, another option I'd imagine is that maybe you read a corrupted file. We read part of the new saved version and part of the old version. But either way, we don't expect a good result if this happens. So what happens if I, what do you think about the second thing? If I save a file while someone else is saving it, what outcome do you expect? Two of us have the same file open, we both press save at the exact same time. Yeah. So you say they get saved to different files?
Yeah.
Okay. What if we're saving to the same file name? Like, save as, exact same name. Yeah.
One might overwrite the other.
Okay, you think one's going to overwrite the other, and if they're at the same time, we don't know which. Yeah. So the observation that NFS uses is that these sorts of scenarios don't have expectations for pretty consistent things happening. That we don't expect, if I open while saving, I'm going to get like a consistent same result that makes sense. If two people save, we don't expect that I know exactly which version is going to be there. So NFS has decided that since most applications don't really care about accessing a file that's open in the sense of like open file descriptor, precisely because our usual open operation is load into memory and our save is save from memory, that most of them don't care about it. So we're just going to deal with consistency for when we open a file to when we close it. So NFS has this open to close consistency model. And it's a compromise. Opening a file is always going to check for an updated version. So if there's a cache copy, we're always going to ask the server on open, hey, did it change? And closing a file is always going to update the cache if the file changed. So this allows all sorts of inconsistency if two applications have the file open. But as far as our word processor case, it actually deals with things fine. As long as we don't save or open at the same time, nothing weird happens, and we probably don't actually have strong expectations about what should happen if I'm opening while someone's saving or two people are saving at the same time. So that's not a big deal. And this means that after we open the file, I don't need to contact the server again for each read I do. I just have the whole thing in my cache. And when I'm writing the file, I don't need to contact the server for each write I do. I just write at the end. And I can make those operations a lot faster. Okay. So you might have complaints that not all applications work like my word processor. Some applications really open a file and keep it open for a long time. You know, and then we might imagine you get these old versions. So there's a slight modification that most NFS servers use, which is that we're also going to check after a certain amount of time. So like maybe every 30 seconds we're going to check. Just in case. So questions out. Yeah, so this is an open to close consistency model. So this deals with those updates very nicely. Now, you might say, this still involves a lot of contacting the server. Was it really worth having our server be stateless? And NFS decidedly said yes, and NFS version 3 and version 4 have basically still said yes. But not all network file systems have made this choice. So I'm going to talk about another Unix-based network file system called the Andrew file system, which uses a stateful server. So they said, stateless, not worthwhile. And the reason they're using a stateful server is not to have the server keep track of file descriptors and so on. They're doing that the same sort of way NFS does it. They're using a stateful server to avoid a repeated, is my cached copy of the file okay? Instead, the server's going to remember you have a copy cached and help you. Now, NFS chooses a different model than NFS. So for NFS like reads and writes blocks of the file at a time, but that's its underlying operation. AFS has a different model for how clients will use the file system. So in AFS, the model is that clients usually cache whole files. So because of that, their read operation is read the whole file, and the write operation is write the whole file. Where the model with NFS is clients sometimes do caching, but that's not the common case. So this means that in the AFS model, we have different results for these inconsistent things. So if I open a file in the AFS model, we always write to the cache copy, and then the last writer wins. In the NFS model, if I open a file and it takes up multiple blocks, we can have this sort of mixed results. Because it just matters what order do we actually end up writing in, assuming we're doing caching. And if we aren't doing caching, or if we evict things from our cache, maybe we do some writes earlier while the file is still open. So I mentioned that AFS does this thing where it keeps some state. And the idea of this state is that it's going to keep track of who has cached copies. So as part of reading a file in AFS, we're going to tell the server that I have a copy and I'd like a callback if that original file changes. So the server state is going to be this list of callbacks. Then later on, if someone else fetches a file and then modifies it, The server is going to look at that list of callbacks and know, oh, hey, client A, your file that you have cached changed. So here we've made a compromise. We said, we're going to make our server keep track of some information in order to make this caching more efficient, which is going to make our server harder to implement and slower. It also makes dealing with failures trickier. So if now the server fails, client A might not get this update properly. And AFS's solution to this is that the client A is responsible for every once in a while checking with the server to, say, make sure the callback is still there. But these callbacks, because AFS allows you to cache the whole file, and we have still have this open to close consistency, don't solve our inconsistency. If two people have the file open at once, we can have this situation where client B here is reading the file after it's written and doesn't see those writes right away, even though they've already happened. And if we were on a single machine, well, when client B is reading here, it would see this write data, this write. But right now, it's not going to see that. It's not going to see it until client A closes. So we still have this window where we have inconsistency, but we decided that's okay because we think that we aren't concerned about what happens between open and closing. And this is the same thing we have with NFS if we don't contact the server, because we only contact the server on open. So with NFS, we have the same problem manifest, even if we did the write right away to the server, because we wouldn't check for update version until we opened again. So here we learn sooner, so it avoids some inconsistency, but we can still lose because the person writing the file doesn't write it to the server right away. So questions on this example? So, yeah. And I guess something I know. So I showed you the last writer wins per block. So with NFS, there's no requirement to not write the file until you close it. So we could potentially have like done these writes while the file was open. Why would we do that? Well, one reason is if we have it open for a while, we probably want to not keep the server too out of date. And another reason might be maybe we don't run out of space to cache things. So NFS is really designed for the model of I'm going to operate my cache the same way I would locally, and that's why it works in blocks. The AFS model was built on this idea that my cache is going to be bigger than it would be normally locally because I'll probably cache things on my local file system even. And that's sort of their idea, is that you copy it to the local file system and you cache it there and in memory rather than contacting the server. And you can see from that idea that there's a reason why AFS might think this idea of callbacks is worthwhile, because by sending whole files, maybe they're saving over NFS as far as how much work the server has to do. So questions on our distributed file systems, or network file systems. These are not distributed, these are network file systems. So our next topic is going to be about security. So we kind of gloss over security in this class mostly, but there are some important things operating systems do that matter for security. And to start this, I want to distinguish between the idea of protection and security. So protection is what we do to control access to resources. These are our mechanisms, like page tables and preemptive scheduling. So page tables control access to memory. Preemptive scheduling controls access to the processor. encryption, controls, the ability, confidentiality of data. And security, we mean using protection to prevent misuse. And we're mostly going to talk about protection mechanisms, about these mechanisms rather than policies. So the important part for like actually deploying this, and what should hopefully be covered if you take a security course, is how do these mechanisms actually translate to something which achieves our properties, like someone can't hack into the bank. But we're mostly going to talk about the mechanisms and kind of gloss over like how exactly that achieves the actual goal. But our hope is that we're going to provide mechanisms which are flexible enough that we can achieve all sorts of different policies, including hopefully the actual ones people have. Now, when we're talking about security, we do have something which is a bit different than something we're used to when we're talking about OS APIs before. And this is that we're dealing with adversaries, meaning that they do the worst possible thing. So, for example, you know, when we talked about the paging assignment, you might say, well, accessing kernel memory should crash because that just is a way to tell the user their program is buggy. But if we're thinking about from an adversary point of view, the concern is, does trying to access kernel memory actually allow the user to manipulate kernel memory in any useful way? And this is a different problem because, like, if your check is off by one, probably it detects the mistakes. But the adversary is not going to make that sort of mistake. They're going to deliberately find that off by one error and access that one byte of kernel memory they can if it's useful. Now, the primary thing operating systems do with respect to protection is that we worry about users, that we divide our system up between users and decide what those users can do. And this gives us sort of two concepts that are important here. So one concept is authentication, figuring out who a user is. And for the most part, operating systems are going to punt on this problem and ask some program to do it. Now, a secondary problem is, given that we know who someone is, what can they do? And this is something where operating systems are going to have to do a lot of work. And we've kind of seen that, like part of it is like, what files can you access, for example? We're going to have to make that sort of decision. But we need authentication before we can do this authorization decision. So, authentication, like there's lots of ways we can do it, and we're mostly going to not deal with how it works in this class. We're just going to track what happens. But you might say, how are we going to actually do it then? Because an important part of like having different people able to do different things in the machine is that we figure out who they are, and the OS needs to know that. So if I'm not telling you how it happens, like, does this mean that I'm just not telling you how part of the OS is implemented? So in a typical OS, the answer is going to be not really. So a typical OS is going to have system calls to set user, to set who it is, and trusted programs that do the authentication. So there's going to be some trusted program which will make a system call to tell the operating system, yes, it's this user because they entered the password or they put their fingerprint there. And that's what we're going to do. That's how we're not going to solve that problem in our operating system. Okay. And we'll pick up on this next time. If there are first questions on this or... Okay. And I guess a note on the... So it occurs to me that in the two-phase assignment, when I updated the template yesterday, I probably made it not work out of the box because I forgot an RPC method. I'll post an update, but you have to change that anyways, so it's not necessarily a big deal. Okay, we'll talk more about security next time.